This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant currency in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, I'm going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets. Each week, we're going to provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide. So, coming up on the show, supply chains definitely in focus. We're going to break down how disruptions and bottlenecks are impacting the automotive, pharma, and shipping industries. Plus, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is also having to navigate that risk. But first, let's get meta, guys. Let's get seriously meta. That's Facebook Metaverse. How long is it going to take to actually be a thing? Mandeep Singh, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Technology Analyst, joins us now. Before I ask that question, can you, as if I was my daughter, explain to me what the Metaverse is supposed to be?
Sure. So Metaverse is really a 3D rendering of what you're doing in apps or, you know, when you're browsing. So it's really a much more immersive experience in terms of what you are doing on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, it's real time and, you know, it can be online shopping. It can be video calls that you're doing on Zoom. So really, I think they have taken gaming a step further in terms of what you could do with online games and really overlay the avatars to real-world activities beyond gaming.
So this is purely for like someone like me, or is it for businesses?
I think there are business use cases that are emerging, especially with video collaboration. So what happened during COVID was video collaboration really took off. And now I think this is a logical evolution of video collaboration in the sense that right now you're staring at, you know, a screen when you are talking to somebody remotely. With a metaverse type experience, you can actually be a lot more kind of involved in how you're interacting with somebody sitting remotely. So the physical boundaries, I think, are going to go away in the sense that even though you are remote and you're talking to somebody on video, it feels like somebody is sitting next to you and you can actually do more kind of ingrained experience in just that type of activity that you're doing.
So how would Facebook then make money off of this? Is it still an ad thing?
Yeah, so Facebook has the social graph. They know about the users, their connections, and really when I look at social network as a concept, I think this takes it a step further and a natural step in its evolution that right now I'm constrained with what I can share with my network. It's either a post or a photo that I want to share or a video. That's the best I can do. This really takes it a step further that you can play games, you can do video chats that are more immersive. And I feel it opens the kind of the creator economy that everyone is targeting. Right? Like, think of creators as people who are creating TikTok videos or YouTube videos. And you can only create videos in a certain way because of the tools that are available. With a metaverse, the new tools that a metaverse can bring, it allows you to create more immersive content. And I think you're going to see a proliferation in creators. And that's where you're going to see more use cases evolve.
So you say it's going to take 3 years for it to gain traction. What is 3 years a long time or a short time in your mind?
Well,
it seems short to me, but
the way we came up with this estimate is we've seen how, you know, new product cycles have evolved with iPhones, with LCD panels, with, you know, AirPods. They're, like, when these new things come about in the market, they are sold in thousands of units initially. So the first couple of years, it's the early adopters play around with it. And then there is this threshold that is reached, which really drives that inflection from thousands to millions of units. And we think that is a function of the content that is available. So in something like Metaverse, okay, if I buy an Oculus headset, VR headset, I'm spending $300, $400. What am I going to do with it? I can play games today, but there is limited content that is available in Metaverse or that VR experience. So as you add more content, there comes a time when it really becomes mainstream in terms of everyone looking to try it out, and they have something for everyone. And I think that stage probably will come in at least 3 years. And that depends a lot on the ecosystem, because Facebook can't do it by themselves. Metaverse can't happen just by Facebook investing billions of dollars. They need the participants.
So who are those participants? Are they like the creators, or are they like the software people? What?
So it's, as of now, it's the gaming companies, the Roblox, the Unity software, the Epic software. So these are sort of fragmented metaverse ecosystems, for lack of a better term. And they have developed these gaming kind of ecosystems where they bring in players to play games, and you can do it through a VR gear, or you can actually do it on the browser as well. So you don't need a VR gear all the time. And so they have the engagement right now in terms of, you know, that metaverse experience. But to extend it beyond gaming into, let's say, video collaboration, that's where you need a Zoom to either participate in the metaverse or come up with its own metaverse. And then Facebook somehow has to tie it all together because they have the user graph.
All right, Mandeep, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Really interesting piece. Mandeep Singh, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Technology Analyst. All right, coming up on the program, we're going to shift to car production and check out the supply log jams and how it's impacting the auto industry and what's the outlook. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele, and it's 13 minutes past the hour. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
So let's dig pretty deep into the supply chain issues across various sectors. First, we want to start with the huge elephant in the room that everyone can see, and that is the car industry, and then how the chip sector and the shortage there is really wreaking havoc on all of these car makers. Kevin Tynan, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Autos Analyst, joins us now. Okay, so how does the chip shortage impact automakers? I know we've talked about it for months, but I feel like it's worth repeating.
Well, and really, it depends on who the automaker is. You know, it really is an opportunity for the domestic U.S. automakers to, you know, realign the way they think about output and inventory at their dealer levels and right-size supply to demand in a way that, as they've been pursuing for decades, and that even bankruptcy couldn't do. So I think while you certainly don't want 20 days supply is, you know, around the range where we are now, you also don't want to go back to that 80-day supply that got very expensive in carrying costs and incentives and discounting for your dealerships. You know, so I would say that the room that the Ford and GM and Stellantis' U.S. brands have to navigate is way different than what European or Asia-based manufacturers are trying to do, which is get back to where they were. I think our domestic guys don't want to be back to where they were. And to give you an example, pricing in the U.S., new vehicle pricing in the U.S. in October, industry-wide, was above sticker price. Right?
That's
first
crazy.
Time ever.
That's
right,
crazy.
Right. I mean, usually that discount would be about 6.5%, which is roughly $2,500 to $2,700. Consumers paid $150 over sticker on average in the month of October. So there's a lot of parts, not necessarily in the supply chain, but at the manufacturing and out the retail level, that are saying like, hey, we don't hate this so much. This is actually what we've been trying to do for a really long time.
That's a really, really excellent point that I feel like we overlook quite a bit. Before we go any further, literally, where are the chips in the car? Where do they sit? What do they do?
Well, now they're everywhere, right? And if you think about everything from your, what we would call the center stack, right, where your screen and your audio, navigation, but then it's also what we call advanced driver assist system. So that's your lane keep or your departure warnings or your emergency braking. It's everywhere now, and that's just what you can see. And then when you think about engine mapping, air fuel mixture, and so basically the computer is taking all these inputs from the temperature of the air outside and running it through chips and computers to process the most efficient way to run the engine. So they are everywhere.
So then do we know what automakers think is the right inventory now? Like if they had too much and this is forcing it to get too low, do we know what they think is right?
Yeah, so typically that number is industry-wide in the U.S. It's considered 60 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want 2 months of supply. That's where carrying costs start to get prohibitive, even for dealerships. Our domestic guys were running 80 days on average. Ford was mm-hmm. 77. GM was up in the 70s. They're talking about being 50 to 60 days, which is where, you know, the Toyotas and the Subarus of the world typically live in the U.S. And I think what you're going to see is more of what the automakers call an order bank, where it's, hey, you order it, we'll build it, you'll get it. There'll be some of the higher volume things. Ford's F-150 will be on the dealer lot, but it's not going to be a lot of these slow moving, low margin vehicles that are just sitting, taking up space anymore. So I would say 50 to 60 days, which is considered manageable for the industry, is where our domestic guys want to be. And like I said, they have more room to go, right? They were 80 where the European and the Asia brands were already at 50 to 60 days, if not below.
So I know you're a car guy, but I'm wondering if the chip sector is overestimating the need for chips then, because it feels like everyone's like, yep, we're going to just jam out supply, but not if the car makers are going to keep a leaner inventory than we're used to.
Right. Yeah. And there's two sides of it. I think technology wise, we're going to need more and more processing, more and more chips as time goes. And as we move towards electrification and towards autonomous, or even not fully self-driving, but as there's more driver assist systems, we're going to need more chips. That point is certainly correct. I think that, and I get that question all the time, oh, when is it back to normal? I'm saying it's not going to be back to normal, or at least the manufacturers and the dealers don't want it to go back to 2019, where the model was overproduced to cover fixed costs and then just jam it on your dealers and then figure out how to sell it with discounts and incentives. We're not going back to that, at least not for a while, or hopefully ever, and from the mindset of the automakers. So we'll need more chips, but we won't need chips in as many vehicles, I think, going forward.
Do you think that the market is prepped for that?
Probably not, no. But if you think of the alternative, it's, and I've had people say, well, why don't you just stockpile chips? And I say, well, what if it's you can't get aluminum, right? You know, where you're preparing for the storm of the century by driving a big SUV when, you know, it may not happen.
Mm-hmm,
So you're not going to realign your entire enterprise and your cost structure for the possibility that there's this shortage of something. And what if you pick wrong? There's just too many parts and components in a vehicle to really do anything more than a just-in-time kind of model.
Will used car prices be somewhat permanently higher? Will car prices in general be permanently higher in some capacity?
I think so. And, you know, the other thing I believe is that I don't think the consumer will mind that much. I think, you know, when you hear about Tesla and how much people like that buying experience of going direct, and you're essentially paying sticker price for Tesla. And I tell people all the time, well, oh, I love buying from Tesla, but going to a dealership, I never want to do that again. And I say, well, walk into a dealership and offer to pay sticker and see how great that transaction is, right? They'll love you. They'll sit you right down. You'll sign some things. You'll be out the door. So I think that if the consumer has transparency and an easier process, even paying more for those vehicles will be acceptable. It's the go in and haggle and back and forth and talk to the manager and then hidden fees and costs so that the dealer can make some margin on the vehicles becomes the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think we'll be paying a little bit more, but I don't think the consumer will really mind.
Kevin, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Kevin Tynan, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Autos Analyst. Coming up on the program, it's how supply chain risks are actually going to force U.S. pharma companies to shift more domestic production And maybe that's going to cost everybody. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BIGO on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele, and it's 25 minutes past the hour. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We're here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide. So we're taking a deep dive in the supply chain risks into different sectors. We talked about the auto industry. Now let's talk about U.S. pharma. I'm joined now by Anne Hunter Van Kirk, Bloomberg Intelligence senior biopharmaceutical equity research analyst. So Anne Hunter, before we get to like what's gonna it's gonna look like, where are the supply chain problems with big pharma?
So the big problems are really, like many industries, the pandemic has really highlighted that the large reliance of drug manufacturers on certain geographic areas. And so in the past decade, we've really seen India and China have grown to dominate the pharmaceutical manufacturing field, largely been based on lowering costs like other areas. And the question is sort of, what is the future of this trend? Will Eastern manufacturers continue to dominate? Or will there be a renewed interest in Western manufacturing, really based on kind of an undiversified supply chain as a risk?
Right. So what parts of the supply chain could realistically become more domestic?
In the pharmaceutical side, you see this sort of cycle of raw materials, which are developed into the critical active pharmaceutical ingredients, or API, which is then added to excipients, non-active ingredients, and then measured and dosed for packaging to create finished drugs. So really any part of that cycle, but most strongly the API, is what's being outsourced.
Hmm. What part of this is cyclical at all? So if we talk just about semis, for example, this is how boom and bust cycle go for the semiconductor sector. Is it like that in the pharma sector?
The pharma sector, well, first of all, we see a lot, we have a lot less visibility than something like autos because it's proprietary and you're constantly seeing new innovation. And so it's a lot harder to track the changes for sure. But it's something that I would say probably is a slower cycle than something like transportation, where it's more based probably on shipping costs. This cycle is slower, and these factories require a lot of in-depth knowledge, which is difficult to transfer.
What companies do you think are kind of best geared to make these changes?
On a company basis, I mean, the big generic companies are probably the ones that have seen the most outsourcing. That's where we've seen the outsourcing being led. And it might kind of pull back really with a rise of, you know, biologics and more complex manufacturing. A lot of those biologics actually require cold storage and things like that. And so it's something that could shift as we get more complex drugs.
Now, what are the countries that we're most exposed to? Is it straight up like a China-India story?
It is definitely a China-India story. If I can pull some data for you here, the weighted average percentage of non-U.S. facilities operated by major manufacturers, including Teva, Eli Lilly, and Sun Pharma, rose to about 80% in 2019 for my data, up from about 60% in 2020.
So what's the benefit to operating there in China and India, for example?
Costs, really, like everything else. Mm-hmm. Higher costs for pharmaceutical manufacturing. A lot of that is driven by wages, and that's an interesting component of it, because that's something that we're seeing compress a little bit. Obviously, there's still a huge gap, but for another data point for you, wages of U.S. pharma manufacturing employees averaged about $110,000 a year in 2019, which was about a little over four times that of India, which was about $25,000 a year.
Whoa. Okay. So if these companies say buy India, China, and come back to the U.S., like, that's some serious cost increases we're going to see.
That certainly would be. But, you know, the flip side, and particularly if you have to cold ship things, that is a huge cost, right? And so that's something that could be offsetting it. And at the end of the day, the development for these drugs is certainly the larger component of costs than the the manufacturing, I would say.
Also, what could be the benefit, aside from like having it be closer and not having the logistics and stuff like that, but is there a regulatory benefit too that these companies would have if they onshored everything?
The regulatory benefit, I think the FDA is working on making that not a huge benefit. They do check all facilities, both ex-US as well as US. It's obviously easier for them to check the US facilities and do more checks there, but it's something that they try to standardize because, of course, this is U.S. Consumers that are consuming them.
Ann Hunter, thanks a lot. Ann Hunter Van Kirk joining us there, Bloomberg Intelligence, a senior biopharmaceutical equity research analyst. All right, so coming up on the program, we're going to take a look at the outlook for freight rates as shipping demand still soars, and plus how Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is dealing with some economic weakness and those supply chain problems. You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele. It is 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
You can't talk about supply chain issues without looking at the shipping industry. I mean, freight costs have just gone bananas this year, around record highs. Even if they've come off the highs a little bit, they're still so elevated. So I'm joined now by Stefan Kovachev, a Bloomberg Intelligence credit analyst. So let's talk about the freight industry. Have we seen the peak? How are they doing?
We are there. We are at the peak, Alex, and we think it may get worse before it gets better. I think record freight rates are here because of a supply and demand imbalance. On one hand, we've seen finished goods, which have been in demand on the back of the pandemic, as people were staying at home and buying furniture, as opposed to traveling and going to restaurants. And on the other hand, on the supplied side, there are about 6,000 container ships in the world, and it takes 2 to 3 years to build a new one. So it takes time to add capacity, which means that, as GDP expectations for next year are strong, we may see a continuation of these relatively high freight rates.
If I said something like, we'll return to normal, what does this new normal potentially look like?
I think, as economies reopen, we may be, more tempted to go back to travel and, spend more on entertainment as opposed to goods. But I think the whole shift to buying online, and just because it's more convenient as opposed to actually going to the store, and the whole stay at home and work from home will be, to some extent, the new normal going forward. Mm-hmm. So I think the supply chain issues may continue because of strong demand. We've seen congestion at many ports, etc. So if demand remains strong and supply of new ships takes time to come on board, it may be a very tense environment for freight rates in the coming year.
Do you think, let's pretend like we could get like all the freights we needed, all the vessels we needed tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Does that solve the problem? Or is it really then also a port issue?
You're right, Alex. It's very much a port issue. And we've had a variety of different bottlenecks, be it, the lack of truck drivers in the U.S. It may be up to 80,000 truck drivers which are missing. So yes, you're right. Even if we have magically all the ships we need tomorrow, the problem is that currently, if we lack the truck drivers, we can't get the goods to the shops. So there are a lot of problems which optically will reduce the number of available ships if they are stranded outside of Long Beach, for instance. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are a lot of other bottlenecks that need to be resolved, and this will take time.
What do you think companies' solution to this is going to be? I mean, are companies going to build their own vessels so they don't have to worry about this?
Well, some companies have tried to charter vessels and operate their own fleet, but it's not that easy it's a very complicated industry to operate. It sounds easy, as in, the containers are very much standardized. You put them on the ship and unload them at destination. But in order for the companies to be profitable in this environment, the ships need to be filled pretty much at capacity. So if a ship is 80% full, it loses money. If it's 90% full, it's break even. And let's say 95%, it makes a good amount of money. So I think the bigger companies are in a better place to make sure that their ships are full, especially as we have this just-in-time supply chain that has been quite successful up until now.
You're a credit analyst. So what is the credit market telling you about the winners and losers in this space?
Well, I think CMA CGM, a French company, number three in the market, has been one of the biggest winners so far. To put it simply, because they have been more aggressive in the past in terms of net leverage, in terms of debt usage. But the way they have been positioned is that they have more exposure to more profitable routes, such as Asia to North America. And they have also bought a logistical company, Siva, which actually moved just before the pandemic, which helped them diversify revenues and to an extent prepare for the pandemic. So looking at the credit market, the biggest gainers have been the lower rated players. So CMA CGM is one, Hapag-Lloyd is another high yield player, which have outperformed the investment grade leader in the industry, which is Maersk.
Who is going to have a hard time keeping up?
Well, I think the smaller players in the industry, it is a very fragmented industry. CMA CGM, I was mentioning, number three player with a market share of only about 12%. So we've had a default of a Korean operator back in 2016, and what happened back then was that the actual ports were not really keen to accept the ships of this operator because they were afraid that maybe they will not be able to pay the fees, the docking fees, the unloading fees, etc. So I think the bigger players are better positioned especially as the industry becomes more competitive with more capacity eventually coming online, maybe 2023. I think its size matters in such a small margin, competitive and volatile industry.
I hear consolidation coming. All right, Stefan, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. Stefan Kovachev, Bloomberg Intelligence credit analyst. All right, let's turn to the master himself, Warren Buffett. Cash at Berkshire Hathaway is at a record. Supply chains, though, are definitely going to wind up hurting different portfolio companies within Berkshire Hathaway. So I want to get a deeper take here. I'm joined by Matt Palazzoa, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior PNC Insurance Analyst. Okay, Matt, so what did we learn about supply chains through Berkshire Hathaway?
Yeah, so it's interesting, Alex. The biggest impact in the third quarter was, I think, actually in their insurance business. Their other operating businesses are certainly at risk in the next couple of quarters. But what happened is inflation in auto parts has been a significant issue, which I think we've kind of all heard about, the chip shortage and different parts costing more. And GEICO, which is owned by Berkshire Hathaway, saw their underwriting results really get creamed in the quarter on not only more miles driven after the lull from the pandemic, but on this higher auto parts costs.
Interesting. Is that going to resolve itself? Do we have a guidance for that?
They didn't give any guidance for that. I mean, I think the miles will continue to hurt, I think, going into early next year. And really, it's up to when these kind of chip shortages end. So I think this could be pain for all auto insurers probably going into or through 2022.
What else did you notice? What else did we learn?
The operating companies are just really strong. They're really best-in-class companies. Their earnings in 2021 so far are above pre-pandemic levels, but we did see some cracks. So if you look at Burlington Northern, the railroad, their volumes, kind of jumped up throughout the year, which makes sense. But so far in the fourth quarter, they're starting to dip. So I think, everything great on the operating front, but worries potentially ahead with the supply chain.
Well, I was thinking too, because like Warren Buffett likes to invest in things that he knows, and a lot of that is food and consumer staples and things like, you know, ketchup, like that kind of stuff, which I think in terms of labor and supply chain issues would be really front and center in this whole thing.
I think so. I think, you know, what we'll be doing work on going into next year is how much cost they can pass on to the customer. So I think, you know, probably more so than in kind of maybe past inflationary scenarios, the consumer seems to be probably in better shape to absorb some of this. So I don't have an answer for that right now, but I think that's a big question for the stock going into 2022.
No, it's fair enough. And I mean, obviously, these companies are going to be well-run and stripped out efficiencies and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so I mentioned earlier that we're looking at record cash. What is he going to do with it? We saw a buyback, right?
So that seems to be the plan. And, you know, what happened was when valuations took a hit in early last year, Berkshire didn't do anything. And Buffett had said earlier this year that he lamented that. He said we should have acted, and we didn't. And what happened? Valuations just got more rich in between then and now. So in my view, it just makes any targets that he was potentially looking at even more expensive. I would always say Buffett can always look past valuation if there's a best-in-class company, and there could be some diamond in the rough out there. But it just seems like the way the market moved, they're just less likely to do something.
Right, so then they just return cash to shareholders?
Yeah, and, you know, there's limits, right? It's not a liquid stock, so they can only buy back so much. But, you know, they've been buying back hand over fist with like $20 billion worth of stock so far this year, and I think that's, you know, at least they do that next year.
All right, really interesting stuff, Matt. Thanks a lot. Matt Palazzoa of Bloomberg Intelligence, the senior PNC insurance analyst. That is this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing you in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. Remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on your terminal. I'm Alex Steele. It is 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.